if some of these folks had any power, they'd put us in ovens. In the city of Lost Wages that week, resistance was focused on the NAB. That's the National Association of Broadcasters, whose members are transnational commercial media titans such as Disney and Westinghouse. According to journalism professor Robert McChesney, it represents a force that is the country's most powerful lobby. At last winter's board meeting in Laguna Niguel, California, the NAB declared all-out war on the micropower movement, passing a resolution urging the Department of Justice to create a task force to stamp out unlicensed stations. We stand ready to support the government's effort to eliminate unlicensed radio broadcast stations in the United States, an NAB lackey said. This year's conference, NAB 98, was dubbed the Convergence Marketplace, since it is, quote, the association's final conference before the rollout of digital TV, as the NAB Daily News put it. In that same journal, Robert Kapler writes, the time also marks a historic period for radio as this segment of the industry debates very seriously technical issues surrounding digital radio transmission, industry consolidation, and radio's place in multimedia and on the Internet. Dennis Wharton, spokesman for the NAB, commented gleefully, the Telecom Act of 1996 certainly helped enable the growth of the industry, and now that Wall Street and local banking community are recognizing radio as a good investment, there really is nowhere to go but up. Surveying the same terrain from the people's angle was Dunifer's attorney, Luke Hyken, of the National Lawyers Guild, CDC. Hyken addressed the micropower gathering on Monday the 5th, and then an NAB panel, originally titled Will Pirate Radio Walk the Plank, on the 6th, on the very day the NAB was inducting Rush Limbaugh into their Hall of Fame. Hyken explained that radio is the media sector most thoroughly affected by the recent Telecommunications Act. In the 20 months since the law came into effect, 4,000 of the nation's 11,000 radio stations have changed hands, and there have been over 1,000 radio company mergers. Radio has become nothing but a profit engine for a handful of firms so that they can convert radio broadcasting into the most efficient conduit possible for advertising. Hyken went on to quote the text of the Communications Act of 1934 itself, 47 U.S.C. paragraph 151, as amended to 996, which states that the Act's raison d'etre is as follows, to make available so far as possible to all the people of the United States without discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, or sex, a rapid, efficient, nationwide, and worldwide wire and radio communications service with adequate facilities at reasonable charges. Hyken then asked, does the present media system in which broadcasting is the primary channel of communication, information, and dialogue for our democracy meet this constitutional and legislative mandate? Are there a broad spectrum of views and opinions available to people of the United States? Do people hear about choices other than Clinton or Dole? Is the view that the economy is not so rosy for the one-third of American children living below the poverty line up for discussion? Does anyone who thinks that the war on some drugs isn't such a hot idea have an audience? Is a media system which grants access to only a narrow range of views constitutional? Is a media system where the price of a soapbox is millions and millions of dollars constitutional? Of the 10 to 12 people who approached the microphone during the question and answer period following Hyken's presentation, only two were supportive. According to an audience member, the crowd that spoke at the microphones was predictably hostile. Most cited horror stories of interference and or blatant commercialism. In each such case, Luke Hyken stated clearly that we do not support abuses, but are simply seeking a legal low-power radio service for community use. Interestingly, Hyken noted that he was approached privately afterward by not a few sympathizers. As that panel wrapped up, National Association of Broadcasters streamed out of the Las Vegas Convention Center, encountered a demonstration staged by the free radio proponents. Protesters wielded signs reading, "Don't let them NAB our airwaves," and "NAB gags free speech." Some wore gags inscribed with the initials FCC. A blue blazer adorned passerby, unofficial NAB uniform, was overheard to mutter, "Get a real job." Security emerged shortly and informed the group that they were trespassing and would be subject to arrest if they did not immediately vacate. The protesters were advised to allow themselves to be escorted down to the boulevard directly across the street from a clamorous billboard-sized screen advertising a steady stream of shiny mixers and consoles. The group lined up beneath another sign flashing messages such as "Experience the Power" and unfurled a banner. With the aid of a megaphone, they testified for over an hour. The demo made the local news and was picked up by a CBS national news the next morning. The head counsel for the NAB was glimpsed milling about the protest, perhaps a gauge of its impact. The final day of the conference was given over to technical information on how to transfer good quality audio content over the net. The great implication for micropower programming is that stations could get local news from all over the world, making feasible national or international news shows. For example, Food Not Bombs, who provided tasty, healthy meals for the duration of the free radio gathering, could put their show online and stations could download it at no charge with CD quality sound. This service has been centralized as the Radio for All website, http://www.radioforall.org. A prime focus was defense strategy, appropriately enough, as 162 stations have been raided in the last year. I repeat, 162 stations have been raided in the last year. A hot topic was the case of Lonnie Cobrice, operator of Luntz Community Radio of Tampa. According to AINFO's website, Luntz faces a possible $28 million fine and or 28 years in federal prison for operating his radio station without federal permission. The decision to prosecute Mr. Cobrice is obviously meant to frighten other operators and maybe the start of an unhappy new trend toward criminal prosecution of unlicensed broadcasters. Clearly, this is one of the most important battles currently on the horizon. Some feel that Luntz, a right-winger, has been targeted strategically to divide the movement. The AINFO site suggests sending a note of support and a donation to Lonnie Cobrice, care of 1715 East Fowler Avenue, number 117 Tampa, Florida, 33612. This is a historic time for low-power radio because the FCC may repeal the regulations that have been on the books since 1979, when the agency decreed that no standalone broadcast station that pumps out less than 100 watts can qualify for a license. In the FCC's words, these are the rules that Dunifer argues, quote, operate as an unduly restrictive, total ban against low-power broadcasting and thus contravene the First Amendment right of free speech. The FCC has released a notice of inquiry with respect to the question of whether it should open a formal rulemaking proceeding to review this ban. The heart of Hyken's presentation to the National Association of Broadcasters was a 10-point proposal, a key provision of which, in lieu of the April 1997 giveaway of licenses for digital television broadcasting to the corporations, is that, quote, when television broadcast stations go digital, leaving Channel 6 free, it shall be allocated as an extension to the bottom of the FM band strictly for low-power community FM service. That 10-point proposal has been put on the Radio for All website, www.radioforall.org/news/rm9208.html, and for those who want that, of course, you can get that after the show, for people to sign on to as part of the National Lawyers Guild CDC proposed filing with the FCC in the agency's preliminary rulemaking. Any microstation, organization, or individual may sign on. The comment period will last until May 27th. New FCC Chairman William Kennard has given lip service to consolidation issues and voiced support for legalizing some type of low-power service. However, there should be no illusion about Kennard. As Wharton put it, to his credit, Chairman Kennard has said he will continue the FCC's efforts to curb pirate radio. The NLG, National Lawyers Guild CDC, points out that even if the FCC did consider low-power our stations for a license, there would still be the problem that, quote, it requires all potential licensees to conduct expensive engineering studies, which for a typical new station amounts to over $250,000. And as Peter Frank of the National Lawyers Guild points out, we must insist on an entire community, not entrepreneur-based, non-commercial service. Otherwise, micro radio can be swallowed up by micro business. And that's Radio Free Vegas, the only public radio left in America, by Scott Pfeiffer in the May 6th issue of the Anderson Valley Advertiser. For those of you who want more information about this article, give me a call after the show at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I'll give you more information. You can also pick up a copy of the Anderson Valley Advertiser in the book loft which is right next to the Rio Theater at Soquel and Seabright, for those of you who are interested in the article. Well, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. You're listening to Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Our phone lines are open at 423-5361. I'd like to announce that Earth First Radio, which comes on after my show at 8 o'clock, tonight's show is going to be a tape of the Judy Berry benefit last year, and next week is the anniversary of the bombing. Uncle Dennis himself, the usual talk show host of Earth First Radio, will be in later with announcements. That's going to be happening in about 15 minutes. Before that does happen, though, I'd like to kind of give you a taste of what happened with some of us this, I guess, was it this weekend? No, I think it was last weekend. We went to a conference in Sacramento in which we talked about civil rights for the homeless. And we worked on the, we had a fairly big audience. Some interesting questions came up. I'm going to play you a portion of it. You're going to be hearing myself speaking, video journalist and writer Becky Johnson, and also Santa Monica homeless activist Jennifer Wagoner, who since Thursday or so has been with homeless people in front of City Hall in Santa Monica in the rain, protesting the anti-homeless laws and policies of the Santa Monica City Council. Just as in San Diego for the last 2 months, more than 150 to 200 homeless people, I was quite impressed with the numbers, have been in front of their City Hall and in front of a populated shopping center, Horton Plaza, down in San Diego, protesting the failure of the San Diego to either provide shelter or decriminalize homelessness. Let's hear a little of Housing 98 Civil Rights Conference, the Civil Rights Workshop at that conference.
What do the police do? Do they take them to jail? Do they have
a usually they give them a ticket, which will later turn into a warning, which will result in them going to jail at a later point when they're arrested somehow. And they tell them to move on. They'll wake them up, tell them to move on. Sometimes they get arrested or just driven out of town, but usually police don't want to waste their time with that except to get them out of it. So it becomes a form of harassment, particularly if you're working homeless people, a person that's difficult. That ties in with the question you asked, which has to do with what civil rights are we talking about? The civil rights we're talking about, I guess, did you want to talk about, did Becky, you want to say something about that?
I think you just mentioned what some of the actions are in various cities, California are fighting different issues.
The basic kinds of civil rights that homeless people face are ones which most of us take for granted, which is being able to be in public spaces without harassment. In San Jose, there's an anti-sitting law, which makes it a crime punishable by up to 6 months in jail or a $1,000 fine to sit down, except at a bus stop or in a park. Parks close at dusk. There aren't that many bus stops. Guess what happens to folks? They're getting ticketed and harassed. I don't know whether they're being jailed for 6 months. That's one of them. The right to sit down. The right to sleep at night is another basic civil right that homeless people frequently don't have in most cities. Their so-called camping ordinances are actually no sleeping ordinances, which means that there's, in a place like San Diego, where there's more than 5,000 homeless people and there's shelter spaces by St. Vincent's where only 2,000 of them, 3,000 of them are illegal at night. So there's another example of a civil right, the right to sleep. There are a series of other rights. We're kind of going after these basic rights to begin with, sleeping and the right to be in public spaces. But the right to keep clean, let's say. Jennifer, for example, last summer, she can tell you about this, but she tried to open up showers that the cities of Santa Monica had closed, previously been open to the public, because of anti-homeless discrimination.
Can I say something?
Sure, although we're...
There's a number of laws that are supposed to protect people's civil and human rights. We have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and I'll pass these out. These are the only copies that I have with me, but if you give me your name and address, I can send some of these to you. It's from the United Nations. And basically, it outlines that everyone has a right to food, clothing, shelter, and a choice of employment. We have a variety of things like legislation that are coming down actually criminalizing poor people. So, how do you defend the civil and human rights of poor people from where you are? That's the question here. So if you, if there's a situation where people are not getting access to food, there's a situation where they're not getting access to housing, and suddenly they're going to jail because jail is the only guarantee of affordable housing in this country at this time, what do you do? I mean, some of us provide support through agencies and support mechanism services, but there's also a situation in our country where people are actually going through a criminalization process. If you're waiting out on the streets for social services, you face citations, you face jail, and there's got to be a way to highlight that. In the documents that I'm passing around, you'll see on the front page it says Miami settles homeless lawsuits. And basically the ACLU took the city of Miami to court for a historic amount of violations that happened to homeless people. Homeless people were being ticketed for being outside. Homeless people were being jailed for being outside, for having property. They were having their property taken away. So the way that the ACLU did it, which we can get the ACLU in all of our cities to do, is that you document what is happening to homeless people. I have right here pictures of rain conditions. I have pictures of people just standing outside out in the rain. You have to go and you have to get testimony of people who have been suffering and why they have been suffering. And eventually, if you get up enough citations, you get up enough evidence, you can actually do something to protect the civil rights of homeless people, like filing a report with the United Nations, documenting abuses, or you can do it locally. Like in our paper, the homeless paper, I list citations that people have received, the citation number, the officer who issued it, exactly what the citation was, what the fine is, what the penalty is, and it's all clear right there in a little block. And I list all of people's citations. A, it's a mechanism where people can feel like, okay, I wasn't just abused and silenced. You know, everyone gets to know that I got a citation and I go through this process. This amount of suffering is at least heard. But then, it's also a tool where, you know, you can go to the city and say, look at all of these people who are getting cited for covering up with a blanket, you know, recycling to save our planet, you know. They get a ticket for pushing a shopping cart. It's all there. They can't just hide behind this facade of, you know, oh, so many people get so many citations. You have them up front, close, and personal. So, I mean, I know you're shaking your head, you're not getting there.
Well, honestly, I mean, I don't want to belabor the point. You have a lot of information. Human rights aren't the same as civil rights. And, I mean, I think we're being very imprecise in our language. And that's okay. I'm not saying I'm in favor of these horrible things. I would just like us to be more precise in our language. What, I mean, this gentleman started to list specifically the things one ought to advocate for. I'd like to know just what is the base. For instance, the Human Rights Declaration has no coercive authority in the United States. I mean, so, I mean...
The United States
has... that we're basing on, and you started to do that. And so, I mean, civil rights and jurisprudence means something very specific.
So let me say this. You're quite right in terms of... sorry, do you mind?
Yeah, let me just say really quick that human rights... It's international law. The United States actually signed on to the document. So in theory, we should be practicing it. What is missing from our society is a mechanism to address human rights violations in our own communities. Human rights law is not recognized in municipal law. That's a problem that we all share. Where it turns into civil rights is when you are being denied your human rights. You have no access to affordable housing, you have no access to food, if you have no access to shelter and employment, and you get a citation for that condition, an economic condition that you did not deserve, and you have no legal recourse to defend yourself in the system, that is a violation of your civil rights, and that's where it connects.
Well, yeah, I think the point you're trying to make is that there are distinctions between civil rights and human rights. What we're looking to deal with here are really human rights issues. So maybe that clears it up for you. You know, I mean, you're quite right. I mean, our civil rights are becoming more and more limited by a very conservative Supreme Court, both at the state and local levels. There are still legal recourses. For example, in San Francisco, homeless agencies are suing the authorities in small claims court to get back property, which is now being stolen under Willie Brown's increased matrix program. Brown has a program that is twice as intense as Jordan's, even though it doesn't go by that name, unfortunately. So there are ways of dealing with it, but we're looking for ways of networking around human rights issues that include civil rights as well.
I'm involved in litigation where we sued the Merced County Community Action Agency, an employee.
Stand up.
Is sitting right in the second row here. In the homeless shelter that we sued, it was an emergency winter homeless shelter for adults. And people were required, in order to get the benefits, to submit to pat down searches before they came and go in. And if there was no woman around to do it, men were supposed to conduct these searches and in fact do that. And that is a clear-cut violation of working with be free from unreasonable searches. It's a violation of their right to privacy as well. Once I got inside the shelter, there was a rule that said you cannot behave in a way which is deemed to be obnoxious, very vague words like offensive, and if someone who is employed or volunteered at the shelter deemed that your behavior was obnoxious, say you said damn, someone could deem that to be obnoxious, you could lose your benefits at the shelter. They employed armed guards to control the shelter, not the perimeter, so that it was a matter of protecting the shelter residents, but they went to the cabins and looked at them like every hour or something during the night. There were no curtains on the windows. They were prohibited, so these armed guards could see into the shelter cabins and see what you were doing in case you were doing something they didn't want you to do.
Let me interrupt you for a minute, because this is all important stuff. But what we're hoping to do, and this is going to be kind of the next phase of what we're talking about here, is not just lecture at you and just have you sort of, you know, hear us talk. We want to hear you talk, because you have come from different parts of California and perhaps elsewhere in the nation that we don't know about. We don't know what's going on. And actually, more important, we don't have time for everybody, obviously, to make their presentation. We'd like to find ways so that each of you in your home city gets support for an issue around civil or human rights for homeless people, which you feel is an issue in your city, an important issue. And we kind of come up with this idea, the way to do it, is to have us break down for about 5 or 10 minutes into small groups of...
And that was a civil rights conference, actually a workshop at the Housing 98 conference in Sacramento. Give you some idea of what I'm up to when I'm off the air. Anyway, we're at the end of our show, but we have one final call-in from, a member from the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi. Good. I was just calling to let everybody know that we have 10 days left, and we still need lots of signatures, so this is the final push. And so anybody that would like to volunteer, who has already volunteered, we need people on the telephone and signature gatherers, and especially those... My
go ahead.
Son pushing the button. Anyway, those of you that have been collecting signatures and haven't gotten them in yet, we need those petitions in right away so we can count them. So even if you have one signature on your petition, turn it in. If you think you're going to get more petitions, we'll give you a new blank one. But even if you've just got one or two signatures on there, we need to have those turned in to either David Silva's house at 144 Belmont Street or Becky Johnson's house, which, Robert, what's the address there?
I believe that is 706 Frederick Street.
706 Frederick Street. Or you can turn them in on at Loudon Nelson Center on Saturdays at 1:30 on the back porch. You can call me if you have any questions at 459-0837.
459-0837.
Or what about maybe David's number or Becky's number as
well?
Right,
you can also call David Silva at 429-5284.
Or
you can call Becky Johnson at 429-8529. A lot of numbers to give. If you have any questions, you can also call that famous Huff line, 423-HUFF. Easy number to remember,
yeah.
423-HUFF.
And the main thing is just that we've got a very short period of time left, and I really, really want to see this get on the ballot because people have a right to sleep, and this is the only way it's going to happen is for us to vote it in. So that really needs to be on the ballot. Please help.
All right. Well, thank you, Laura
message.
Tucker.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah, I'll second that, and we've got to go now because we have we're over time. My apologies to Uncle Dennis, who no doubt is about to come in and attack us with a couple of redwood trees. definitely. I believe we're also going to be doing a coffee in the morning at 9:15 at Golden West. If you want to come and help every day, there are going to be three tables available to do tabling at Lucky's and different shopping centers throughout the Santa Cruz area. We need your help now more than ever before.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz as we say goodbye.
Hi, I just wanted to say one more thing, is if you want to sign the petition, then there'll be a table downtown or at the Safeway on the west side or Lucky's on the east side if you haven't signed it yet.
Oh.
And if you were at Earth Day celebration on Earth Day down there at the park, we lost those petitions, so you can re-sign if you signed actually at the park on Earth Day.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
And thank you for tuning in to this edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Come again on Sunday to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. And join us for the Sunday edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. And a week from today, on the air will be Scott Kennedy. That's correct. Councilmember Kennedy has agreed to do a live show on various issues, including Resource Center for Nonviolence's COPS grant, the sleeping ban, and the beach flats, so it could get hot. Stay with us now for Uncle Dennis and his very important, very tuneful, and very pungent show. Thanks for staying around. And we're assuming that at least over the weekend they're not going to do that, but you never can tell what the next week may hold. So we are continuing to broadcast. We will continue to broadcast. In fact, tune in. If you stay tuned, we're going to be doing some talking with Richard Edmondson of San Francisco Liberation up in San Francisco, who will give us a background on the kinds of antics the FCC has been up to in the past around free radio stations, and perhaps what we can expect down here if the FCC decides to take a more repressive position. However, The big news today is we have two hefty and important guests. First-time guests here in the studio, Roxanne Akistapache and Alicia Akistapache, both from the Beach Flats. And I am going to have to somebody has unfortunately scotch-taped or masking-taped down this damn mic, so it's we're all going to have to be kissing each other to talk, but we'll see what we can do here. I ran into Roxanne yesterday at, I guess, the Beach Flats Working Groups Forum. Is that right, Roxanne?
Right. There was a community meeting. Okay, scooting up here. There was a community meeting yesterday just for the purposes of informing the community that's only heard the city side of what the redevelopment plan for the beach area is about. And so since we're limited to 3 minutes speaking times in front of city council and often at really inconvenient times for the public, we tried to hold a forum yesterday where there would be more accessibility to hear kind of the other side of the story.
And what a forum it was. There was a whole roster of eloquent speakers talking to a fairly full room. It even had Mr. Scott Kennedy, council member, who will be, by the way, on the air on Thursday night at 6, giving his side of the story, as well as, I guess, we're going to have probably somebody discussing it with him. Who knows? It might even be you, Roxanne, depending on... I know you and Scott have crossed swords before, so to speak. It was quite a really informative session. We've taped some of it. We can play those tapes later. I'm going to try to make a loop tape for listeners to hear some of that forum, because although we're going to cover a lot of ground today, because you impressed me with the breadth and depth of your knowledge of the Beach Flats based on the kinds of specifics and even a more sweeping considerations that I had not been aware of before, which I heard from you yesterday. We're going to be getting a loop tape together, but today we're going to be, most of the show is going to be taken up with a discussion of the Beach Flats. Why the Beach Flats? Well, this is a show primarily concerned, as listeners know, with civil rights for the poor. We cover that subject, and we will be doing some specifics on demonstration in San Diego. We'll be covering Richard Edmondson's interview, as I mentioned before, on how the FCC deals with micro stations and what micro stations should do when the FCC comes knocking at their door, and a few other things as well. But the Beach Flats is a part of a major redevelopment project. It is a huge redevelopment project, which kind of shows the colors of the city council in more ways than one. It shows the kind of ideological shift that has happened in the last 5 years. And that's significant to me because that shift affects poor people, people who came to office spouting progressive principles and programs, have now turned around and are essentially selling the city to the Seaside Corporation. At least that's how I've seen it based on what I have observed in the situation. But what we need here is to get very specific about it and to provide for a real forum on the subject, not simply to call names, although a few choice names I think would be appropriate as well, but to get to the details. And this, of course, involves people being evicted from their housing, huge impacts on the city in terms of massive numbers of people being siphoned and funneled into the area, and huge amounts of city kind of funding, in a certain sense, by giving away this project to a large local corporation, Charlie Canfield Seaside Corporation. So this is going to impact poor people, and that's my rationale for doing it. And I also think that if we have to work in coalition, concerned with civil rights for poor people, with other groups that are seeing, finally, that these council members who are on the council cannot be trusted to do what they say they're going to do, and they get the endorsement of progressive groups like SCAN, Santa Cruz Action Network, Community Action Board, all kinds of other endorsements and assistance, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and then boom, they grab their seats on the council and away they go, and the city is unrecognizable in a decade. Time to change that, and perhaps the way to change it is by getting together with folks who are dealing with the specific issues, who are fighting their own fights. It's not just their fight, it's all of our fight here. So let's, without further ado, turn to you, Roxanne. You, first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself. How long have you lived in Santa Cruz?
I've been back in Santa Cruz for about 10 years. I have been in the Beach Flats for 3 years. I came to the Beach Flats as a victim, in a way, of development, because the 1920s chicken farm that I lived on, which was part of the Arana Gulch giveaway, was to be developed. And one day, even though we knew that the property had been purchased and was going to be developed, one day the bulldozers just came without telling us and flattened the whole back of the property to the ground. And this was property that was full of berries, fruit trees, 50-year-old roses, just the most beautiful place on earth. And I left promptly. Although I may have had a year to leave, I have to tell you that it just killed me. So we saved about 18 of the roses, dug them out, they were all bleeding, and we ended up in the Beach Flats with them.
Now, is this the same city council
who kind of engineered this development over at Ariana Gulch. And can you give us a kind of a the comic book version of what happened there very briefly?
Gosh, I might not be groovy enough for you because I'm not sure what the comic book version
means.
Well, all I can tell you is I was not active at that time. I was very family involved. I don't exactly know what city council did the Ariana Gulch giveaway, to be really honest. And what happened to me happened kind of out of the blue. And so that it turned my life so upside down because I just lived in the midst of all this beauty. Wild animals came there. It was a refuge. And you're seeing me as an activist today, I think, because of all the things since I've been in Santa Cruz like that have happened to me. And so when I got to the beach area, and
where you've lived since?
I've been there 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Moved in on one of the peak days, July 4th weekend. When I got there and people started saying to me, I started putting in the roses, I dug a pond, I started making improvements on the house I was renting immediately because I wanted to, for fun. Mm-hmm. People would come to me and say, why are you doing that? Why are you spending all this time? You won't even be here in a year. And my heart would just sink. I would think, oh no, you know, I've done it again. And I was pretty destroyed by the way things had happened at my other house. And I had been told I was moving into this horrible area in order to get a rent I could afford, that this area was crime-ridden, dangerous. And I think I was so depressed. I was like, oh, maybe I'll get killed. You know, I could see how depressed the people were there, as far as they didn't think doing anything was worth it, because their land was going to be taken away. They didn't know if their houses were going to be knocked down. And that was the beginning of me always having to, you know, I stopped in the middle of painting my floors because someone assured me that I basically had about 3 months there. And these are the kind of things that the people have been living under there for so long.
So you're saying, Roxanne, that even before the current focus on the beach flats in terms of city council meetings, so neighborhood meetings, that rumors were spreading that you better get ready to move, and that these rumors perhaps, I guess you spoke to me about this earlier, may have influenced a great number of people to vacate even before the current particular focus on the issue.
Yeah, there were two reasons people vacated. One was, they just felt so insecure. They did not know what was going to happen. What the prevailing rumor that was spread in the beach flats was that the city council had already, as far as they were concerned, given the tenants their 30 days notice. And when they decided to come in and start building, 5 days would be what you would get. This wasn't true. I'm just saying that for whatever reason, there were pretty harsh rumors spread around the beach flats, and I can assure you they were not spread by the Latinos, and they were not spread by the landlords that lived there. So I feel that there was an interest in scaring people and keeping them scared probably for the last 5 years.
Where did you first hear those rumors, and where do you think they came from?
Well, I'm not going to say where I heard them, but I'm going to just say that that I heard them frequently. And the reason I'm not going to say where is that, I'm just not going to say where.
At this time, the information is public. let's go on to, give us some idea. How big is the beach flats? How many people live there?
Well,
what's it all about? imagine that our some of our listenership has a very vague idea about that area. Tell us something about the area.
Well, I think it's interesting that where all the Queen Anne's are and the spectacular architecture that we know is on Beach Hill has been separated by name from the lower area where the poor people live. And I'm sorry, but I cannot help but think that beach flats and tortilla flats I just feel like it was really a synonymous kind of thing.
Tortilla Flats, of course, is the name of the book by John Steinbeck.
Right, but where things were not so great and so beautiful, you know. And then there's Beach Hill, you know, where everything's above and
the
beautiful.
Other side of the tracks.
And, I mean, for this area to have its own name is ridiculous. It's a five square block area.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole idea in separating these two areas was then when you began talking, when City Council and the plan came in and everyone was talking about it, they were only, when they said they were impacting the Beach Flats area, they were actually impacting only the poorest section, and they had a smaller area to deal with in terms of, as long as it wasn't all one unified area.
So, again, to remind you who are listening, who perhaps may have just tuned in, we're talking, of course, to Roxanne Akistapache, and we have Alicia as well in the studio is going to be speaking to us. Alicia Akistapache. And the Beach Flats plan is a fourfold plan to open a sort of a La Bahia Hotel Conference Center, to realign 3rd Street, to make numerous significant changes to ingress roads into that area. And what's the fourth part of it?
There's a lot of zone changing from residential to commercial, so mm-hmm. that the area is actually more a commercial area.
And how much is all this going to cost? Do we have any cost estimates on this?
You know, the city cannot give you any. They can't really tell you, and this has been asked of them over and over, what are the costs? I will tell you that a study was done on the realignment of 3rd Street several years ago. At that time, it showed a $2 million investment on the city's part, with $100,000 coming back in taxes a year from that investment,
mm-hmm.
and a $2.8 million benefit to Canfield, and no significant benefit, I believe, to the public.
Well, Canfield is the public, right?
No.
Just kidding.
No.
Just kidding.
And, you know, also, when we talk about public benefit, there's some real jargon going around. When we talk about public benefit, I will tell you that I'm not interested in providing public benefit for people from San Jose. I don't consider it a public benefit if they put in a picnic ground, a little tiny park or picnic ground, next to the boardwalk. They can say, well, you don't have to make a purchase, you don't have to go to the boardwalk to use it. But the truth is, no one's going to sit in bumper-to-bumper traffic, pay $6 to park, and then pull out their peanut butter sandwiches to eat. The benefit is clear, and it's certainly not for the people of the area whose neighborhood is being destroyed, and it's certainly not for the people of Santa Cruz at all. You can call it a public benefit, but it's a public benefit that really only applies to tourists. And I think we have to look at what public benefit really should mean in this, you know, because they use it all the time. Also, there is no plan. There really is no plan for an Ocean Street Bridge, because the general plan adopted the river plan, which talks about lessening the pollution over the river. You can imagine that cars stopped bumper to bumper for 5 minutes at a time on that bridge, what the pollution is doing to the river. And the Ocean Street Bridge would be even that much closer to the river mouth, which is a spawning place for coho, for steelhead. It's actually a very environmentally sensitive place. So there is no plan for an Ocean Street Bridge. There hasn't been for a long time, since the general plan adopted the river restoration plan as part of its general plan to be in line with that. And there actually should be there was talk, and I mean the plan is to widen that river mouth, because the Army Corps of Engineers, when they built the levee, narrowed it. And it needs to be widened for the health of the river. So we're talking about putting new rides adjacent to the already existent levee, which makes it almost impossible then to live up to what we've promised the river.
Yeah, but aren't our promises to Charlie Canfield more important than our promises to people of Santa Cruz?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I don't dislike the boardwalk. And I don't dislike Charles Canfield. I mean, I don't see him as the enemy per se. The problem with this is that Charles Canfield is not, nor is Seaside Company, our local boy company anymore. They have huge investments. They're part of, I believe, an investment corporation called Resorts, Inc., that develop all kinds of land, like in Nevada and in Reno and all the gambling areas, Las Vegas. They're a big deal. And of course, wouldn't you want the beach? If you were a big company, a corporation, wouldn't you want to own that beach area? I mean, it's prime target. And I really think that this is just the first step in taking over that whole bowl. I really believe that they see that as the next Epcot, because the boardwalk is a dinosaur. It can't keep up, no matter how much money they put into it, because it's self-limiting, because of the space it has, because of the history of boardwalks. I mean, it's the only one left, basically. We're kind of supporting a dinosaur anyway, unless we allow it to keep growing. And so I believe that in 8 to 10 years, then my house will be in jeopardy. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
This is a never-ending thing. Or he's going to build it up and get rid of it quick. But I don't think we're just supporting a local boy in mm-hmm. this.
So you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathroom Spears Broadsides. And our guest this morning is Roxanne Aquistapache. And Alicia Aquistapache. If you want to call in, this is a call-in show. If you have questions for our guest, if you have comments, Scott Kennedy, call in. Come on now. You're going to be on the air on Thursday, and you got a right to call in today and put your voice into this as well. You can give a call to 423-5361. 423-5361. Are there considerations that you want to hear about? Considerations that you're hearing about that you don't think are being fully covered or are being inaccurately covered? Hey, 423-5361. We actually have a call, and let's see what we got.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yes, this is Judy Swanson, and I have a question for the Beach Flats resident about what do we hear about the Beach Flats housing that's going to be torn out? Can you describe the houses that are expected to be torn out by the redevelopment? Also, would you touch on the terrible crime statistics that we read about Beach Flats? Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
The caller brought up some really important issues right now, because right now the city is distributing to, at every meeting, in every area, in every office, they have this Beach Flats, I wish I had brought it, a little Xerox sheet about the beach flats. And one of the things that it says is that although we're only 2% of the population, we account for 38%